Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a person a leader for the ages, and how has Edward M. Kennedy evolved as a politician and as a human being to allow him to have such an extraordinary impact on public policy in the United States over the course of his career? With a staff that had covered Ted Kennedy and his intriguing family for more than half a century, Boston Globe's Washington Bureau Chief Peter S. Canellos realized he had extraordinary resources to draw on for a biography of the senator, who was elected to office in 1962. Canellos combined their decades of coverage and a great deal of newly reported information for the biography Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. Peter, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Nobody in the Kennedy family took Teddy very seriously as a kid. Was that simply a factor of being the baby of nine?
I think being the baby was part of it. He was kind of fun-loving. He kind of knew how to get attention. He was the warmest and most affectionate of the Kennedy kids. But, you know, when you carry that profile, you're not the one that the parents put their biggest, greatest hopes and dreams in. And they considered Jack to be the intellectual and Joe Jr. to be the leader and Bobby to be the striver. And Ted was kind of the fun-loving one.
How seriously did he take himself back then?
Well, I think that he took being a Kennedy seriously. And, you know, while his parents, you know, may have viewed him as the kind of fun-loving son, they were very tough on him. And there are a number of letters that have just been released in the last 10 years that we've quoted in this book that sort of just show how exacting, almost to the point of needling, they were about his poor grammar, his poor spelling, his, you know, way of dealing with people, you know, his seriousness about his homework, you know, all those kinds of things that parents do tend to get on their kids for. The Kennedy parents were especially tough. And yet Ted came away kind of loving them and feeling like they were marvelous parents and feeling this deep sense of family loyalty. So he may not have taken himself seriously as an individual, but he took being a Kennedy seriously.
Another thing the family really teased him about, sometimes to the point of cruelty, was his weight. He was kind of a pudgy kid. But in fact, he was quite a good athlete.
Yeah, he was the best athlete of the Kennedy boys. You know, you think of Jack Kennedy and Bobby as sort of expressing a kind of vigor, but Jack Kennedy was a very sickly person, and while he was a great golfer, he really wasn't able to be a, you know, collegiate-quality athlete in anything else. Bobby was also known for his courage and for his driving, but he was not physically very strong. You know, Ted was the real thing. He really was great, played collegiate football, caught a pass that's still kind of semi-legendary over at Harvard these days and to beat Yale, and delighted his father, who was very proud of Ted's athletic accomplishments.
And arranged for him to try out for the Chicago Cubs.
The Bears.
I
think that was sort of, you know, an example of Joe Kennedy Sr., who kind of, you know, decided at some point that he was going to use his wealth only for the betterment of his children, and he didn't want his children to be able to work or have to work. So he used his money and his contacts to try to advance them in any way they could. So I think he had a contact at the Chicago Bears and said, hey, why don't you let Teddy practice with you? But Teddy didn't really seriously think about becoming a professional football player, but he was good.
I wonder, you know, you read about what a hard time he had pleasing his parents, and yet he felt so exceptionally close to them. What does that tell you about the way he chooses to view the world?
I think he chooses to be an optimist. I mean, he's somebody who was very shaped by being the youngest of nine children in a very high-achieving family, and he was raised from the earliest age to look up to his brothers and look up to his parents. And he chose to see the good in them, and as he's proceeded in his political career, he has been able to see the good and to find the areas of agreement with even colleagues who, you know, have polar opposite political views of his. So, he's carried that quality into the United States Senate.
What kind of relationship did he have with Jack and with Bobby Kennedy?
Different relationships. Jack Kennedy was 15 years older, and after their brother Joe Jr. was killed, was the sole focus of Ted's kind of boyhood admiration for his older brother. Jack was also his godfather and played a sort of quasi-parental role towards Ted. But I don't think Ted knew Jack as an adult. At some points, he even, you know, afterwards, you know, confided in friends, you know, I really don't feel like I knew him as an adult. But there was one period where they began to bond, and that was in the very last year of Jack Kennedy's life. Ted entered the United States Senate that January, and suddenly he and Jack had this bond that Bobby at that point didn't have. Bobby had not been in the Senate yet. And so Jack was kind of giving his little brother tips on how to, you know, get to know people, how to be effective in the Senate, how to make relationships. And he noticed that Ted was actually doing it a lot better than he had done it. And for the first time, I think he began to see real political potential in Ted. You know, Ted was always good on the campaign trail, but I think he began to see legislative smarts in his brother and began to invite him to the White House, where the two of them would sort of have drinks at night and talk over politics. And, you know, for Ted to be taken seriously by this much older brother, who was also the president and who, you know, had always been kind of a role model for him, meant a lot. And then, you know, 11 months later, Jack Kennedy was assassinated.
It had to have been something of a double-edged sword for Ted Kennedy to be Jack Kennedy's little brother when he was a freshman senator.
It was a double-edged sword, and I think a lot of the more senior senators expected that he would come in with a bit of an attitude, you know, being the president's brother, being from this famous political family. And he surprised them by how deferential he was to his seniors. And people have often joked that, you know, being the youngest of nine children is perfect preparation for an organization that runs on seniority. And so he had learned how to make friends without stepping on people's prerogatives. And there was one sort of famous anecdote where Richard Russell had been a senator from Georgia for decades and was a powerful Southern committee chairman, you know, was meeting Ted Kennedy. And Ted, in his usual gregarious way, was trying to find some common ground and said, you know, both of us were elected to the Senate when we were really young. And Russell sort of turned to him and said, yes, but I was governor first. And it was sort of a put down to Ted as though his credentials were so slender and Russell's credentials were so great. And I think Ted Kennedy always learned from that and knew how to approach his or learned how to approach his colleagues in a more, friendly and ennobling way.
Joe Kennedy, before Ted was elected to the Senate, assigned him to campaign in the Republican-dominated West when JFK was running for president. That was not an easy task. That was not a giveaway job.
No, it wasn't. And Joe Kennedy Sr. had a special feeling for Ted. And I think his parents had a fondness for him and wanted him to succeed and probably recognized that as the youngest son, he was a little bit sort of underestimated by his brothers, among others. And so Joe Kennedy Sr. played this role where with his son Jack was always insisting that Teddy be given important jobs, even though Jack and Bobby didn't particularly want to give it to him. So when Jack was running for re-election from the Senate in 1958, Joe Sr. insisted that Teddy be named campaign manager as a way of giving Teddy some prominent credentials. And he didn't really manage the campaign, but he did give a lot of speeches and go out and recruit a lot of volunteers and was quite effective on the trail. In the same spirit, Joe Kennedy insisted that he be given the Western states, which were really, really important. Now, again, the evidence is, you know, he wasn't the prime organizer, but he was the person who went out and recruited volunteers and did a very good job at it. Now, Kennedy only won 3 of the 13 states that Teddy had been assigned, so it was a bit of a, you know, mixed result. But there are people to this day who say that he sowed a lot of goodwill out west and actually grew to love the western states himself and even think about moving there.
I have to wonder if the sort of enormous expectations and relentless criticism that he dealt with, even at home, even growing up as a kid, sort of unintentionally prepared him to cope with the kind of media coverage and public vitriol that has dogged him really in his lowest moments.
I think it has. And I think that he, among many others, was shocked by the extent of the vitriol in the 60s and 70s. And it was vitriol, you know, that surrounded all of what would be associated with being the turmoil of the 60s, you know, in the civil rights movement, in the women's movement, in the anti-war movement very prominently. Then for Ted Kennedy himself in the 70s with the busing crisis in Boston, where he was in favor of busing to promote school desegregation, and a lot of his most loyal supporters in Boston were dismayed. And you know, he had one rally where he tried to, you know, give a kind of common conciliatory speech and was just shouted down. People were throwing things at him, and you know, these were his neighbors, these were his people, his political supporters. So I think he found the 60s and 70s to be very, very difficult. But later on, even though he was the symbol to a lot of conservatives of everything that was wrong with the Democratic Party, and he got a lot of, you know, hate mail and negative attention, he began to deal with it much better and put it in perspective.
Why did he marry Joan Kennedy?
I think his parents, again, played a strong role in that. Joe Kennedy Sr. and Rose Kennedy believed that people should get married young and have large families, and they were very pleased that their son Bobby did that. Their son Jack did not. Jack was a bachelor until his late 30s. Even when he was in the Senate, he was kind of a glamorous bachelor, but they felt that it actually hurt Jack's political career, that he was, you know, seen going in and out of nightclubs and things like that. And obviously when Jack did marry, he married somebody who was a huge political asset to him, so I can't say that Joe Sr. and Rose were correct about that, but they did feel like it was a political liability, and they really wanted Ted to marry young. And Joan Kennedy was student at Manhattanville College, which is a Catholic college for girls that the Kennedy daughters had gone to. And they went down to dedicate a building that they had built in memory of their daughter, Kathleen, who had died in a plane crash. And there, Ted met Joan, and Joe and Rose took an immediate liking to Joan and seemed to push Teddy to make a commitment very early.
How invested was he personally in making that relationship work?
It's hard to say. I think that both Joan and Ted were quite young when they married, and as Joan, you know, told our reporters in her interviews, you know, they were sort of by the standards of the 50s. They had like five chaperone dates, and a lot of those dates were spent with her kind of impressing his parents more than him. And you know, he awkwardly proposed to her on the beach one day, saying something like, "Well, what about you and me getting married? How do you feel about that?" And she herself was very nervous as well, and she wanted to postpone the wedding at one point, and her father approached Joe Kennedy Sr. about it, and he said no. So there was a lot of nervousness, I think, on both sides. And I think that, you know, as the years went by, they became fond of one another but didn't have the kind of common interests that many successful couples have.
And Ted Kennedy got some interesting marital advice, if you can call it that, from his brother on his wedding day.
Yes. Well, the Joan Kennedy's family, her father was a well-off advertising executive and was filming the wedding as a gift to the young couple. And when Joan saw the movie of the wedding, she overheard Jack Kennedy turn to Teddy and say, "Just because you're married doesn't mean you have to be faithful." And I would say that was a bad portent for the marriage.
Yeah, I think he took that advice. We'll find out in the next segment, certainly in spades. Was he always a problem drinker in his youth?
No. In fact, Joe Kennedy Sr. promised the kids $1,000 if they refrained from drinking until they were 21, and Ted took it very seriously. So he was not a problem drinker. And in fact, his friends from college, because of a cheating scandal we haven't discussed, he went to college a little bit later, or stayed in college until he was in his, you know, 23 or 24. But from the time in college and in law school, friends say he drank very little.
Peter Escanellos is my guest. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe and the editor of a new book called Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe is with us this hour, Peter S. Canellos. He's the editor of a new book called Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So you mentioned just before the break this cheating problem. Ted Kennedy entered Harvard in 1951 and was very soon, or 1950, was very soon after kicked out.
Yeah, he was a great football player, but concentrated a little too much on football and found himself in danger of flunking out and because of his Spanish exam, which apparently he felt like he was going to fail. So he got a teammate to agree to take the test for him. Both boys were caught and kicked out for 2 years. You could look at that as sort of a harbinger of some, ethical trimming in other incidents in his life. And, this has not been a life free of scandal, as most people know. But there was a sort of silver lining for him in that he spent 2 years in the Army. And his brothers had been in the Navy, and, the Navy is a little more hierarchical. They were officers in the Navy. Ted was a grunt. He was in the bottom of a troop ship cleaning trays. His father was smart enough to see that there was a positive side to this and sent him a letter saying, you're going to learn how, real people live, essentially, and this is going to be an important lesson for you. And indeed, he was challenged to fights and, obliged to get to know people that, the Kennedys never associated with. And many people feel that it sensitized him to average people's concerns, and even comparing him to his brothers, who were fond of the sort of grand gesture, and Robert Kennedy's poverty tour was a very important event. But one-on-one, Ted Kennedy showed more empathy and understanding than his brothers, and a lot of people say it was because of those 2 years he spent in the Army.
Of course, the cheating incident that preceded that did almost come back to haunt him. Can we talk about it that way? And his brother had to sort of help smooth things over when he went to run for Senate.
It's true. He when he went to run for Senate, the rumors started about this cheating incident, and his brother called in the Globe's then Washington bureau chief Bob Healy, and essentially kind of agreed that the Kennedys would release this information, but didn't want it to be portrayed as a cheating scandal, but an exam incident and those kinds of things. And so the paper got the exclusive, but there continue to be suspicions that that President Kennedy was able to get it released in the most innocuous way possible.
I wonder if you can talk for a minute as a journalist, Peter, about how this sort of thing is typically viewed within the media when these deals are attempted to be struck. It is pretty remarkable that it sort of went the Kennedys' way.
Well, I think that, the reporter, Bob Healy, would say they didn't have confirmation for the story and they needed to get it through the White House. So that kind of negotiating back and forth is not a savory part of journalism, I would say, but it sometimes is necessary to getting information out of official sources. The Kennedys at that time had a lot of power and a lot of influence, just as any president does. And it can be a tough game in journalism to try to get the facts out.
How was Ted affected by the assassination of his brother on a personal level?
On a personal level, I think both the assassinations of both brothers were crushing. The assassination of Jack Kennedy was a shock. He was asked by his brother Bobby to go and talk to their parents and to comfort their parents, and he did that and sort of concentrated on being strong for other people, his parents and his wife Joan, who was quite broken up over it. But the assassination of Bobby 5 years later struck him personally more because suddenly he was the last male Kennedy standing and the leader of this political dynasty, and he was only 36 years old, and he had been, again, the youngest, the fun-loving one. He hadn't been raised to be the one on whom all the family's hopes were based, but also on whom, many tens of millions of Americans were looking to to lead them as well.
And he had not been supportive initially of Bobby's plans to run for president. For one thing, he didn't think he could win.
He was not supportive of those plans. Things changed a little in that campaign because initially he had been opposed to it at a time when Bobby was considering challenging Lyndon Johnson. And so the concern about splitting the party is noteworthy because, of course, 12 years later, Ted himself would split the party. But he did not want Bobby to run against Lyndon Johnson. When Lyndon Johnson did less well than expected against Gene McCarthy in the New Hampshire primary that year, Johnson himself pulled out. Then I think that concern about the party was somewhat ameliorated. But Ted's other concern was that Bobby would be a target for assassins, and sadly that proved to be true.
What do we know for certain today about what happened at Chappaquiddick?
Well, what we know for certain is that Mary Jo Kopechne died, and Ted Kennedy has taken responsibility for the accident, for being the driver. We also know that he didn't report the accident in anything like the normal time frame. The questions that linger are whether, you know, for some people, a very salient one is whether if he had reported the accident earlier, there might have been a way to save Mary Jo Kopechne.
Let me stop you for a minute. For people who don't remember the details, he left a party with a woman who was not his wife, Mary Jo Kopechne, and they drove away from there. And there are questions as to where they were going and all that.
Yes, this was a somewhat politically unsavory gathering anyway. It was a cottage on a tiny island off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, and there were six unmarried women and six married men, all older, partying that evening. Kennedy left sometime after midnight, and he was driving with this woman, Mary Jo Kopechne, who'd been a volunteer in his brother's campaign. And he claimed that he was driving to the ferry, and the two of them were going to go back to Martha's Vineyard, where they had hotel rooms, and they were calling it a night. But in fact, Mary Jo Kopechne left her purse and her motel key back at the house, and they drove in the opposite direction to the ferry, and the ferry had stopped running at midnight anyway, and they ended up heading out towards the beach, and there was a small bridge that went over a saltwater channel. The beach was like a sandbar, and there was this fast-moving channel between land and the beach, and it was a somewhat rickety bridge with no guardrails, and Kennedy's car went over the bridge, flipped over entirely, so the car was upside down. And, he has said that, his first thought was how, he was going to die in there, and the water filled the car immediately. And somehow he was able to push open the door and get out. And he said he dove down six or seven times to try to rescue Mary Jo. And he is a very, very strong swimmer, but was unable to do so. And so instead of rushing to the nearest house, and there were some houses with lights on nearby, he went more than a half mile back to the party, the cottage where the party had taken place. And two of the other men from the party then drove back with him, and they say that they tried to rescue her as well. But then when they found that they couldn't, instead of calling the police immediately, the two men went back to the party, and he went back to Edgartown and didn't report the accident until the morning. And he has said that his own actions were unexplainable, and he was shocked, and he had a concussion. But a lot of people strongly believe that he was thinking about the political implications of this accident.
Did all of this and the subsequent publicity and everything, did it chasten Ted Kennedy?
Well, it certainly chastened Ted Kennedy in that he didn't run for president the next two elections. It also, I think, has haunted his sense of himself in all the years since then. One of the things that we write about in the book is how, in a way that has never really been discussed before in the media, every day he calls people in Massachusetts and around the country who've lost loved ones in violent ways, and he offers personal comfort to them and talks about how he coped with the losses in his own life. And many of them report being, astounded that one of the first calls they get is from this famous man who's also famous for having suffered so many griefs in his life. But that kind of, you know, personal extension to people with no political benefit to himself, you know, feels like somebody whose, you know, sense of moral right and wrong has been questioned and who's trying to, you know, make good and show that, you know, on a very personal level, he can be a force for good in the world.
So he didn't run for president in 72, didn't run in 76, did run in 1980, but your sense of it is that he never really was, regardless of what scandal sort of stood in the way, never was that enthusiastic about being president.
No, I think that Ted Kennedy has and had exceptional political talent, but it was not the kind of charismatic talent that his brothers had or that, for example, Barack Obama has. You know, Jack Kennedy, like Obama, sort of projects over a large group of people and becomes this sort of meaningful, kind of almost totemic kind of figure. Ted Kennedy, his strengths are much more one-on-one, much more in the realm of legislative politics, understanding bills and how to get them through and how to build coalitions. And that's a very significant political skill. But after his brothers died, I think he sort of accepted the idea that his life would not really be his own, that he would spend it trying to sort of live the life that they would have lived and take their place. And that led him to run for president and to want to be president, even though it wasn't a perfect, you know, melding of his skills. And so even the aides who were closest to him, and certainly the aides within the Kennedy family played a big role in pushing him to run because these people wanted to get back into power as well. They pushed him hard to run, and a lot of them said, you know, he was always ambivalent. They always sensed that at some level there was a personal reluctance. And obviously in 72, many people had felt he was going to be the nominee. In fact, President Nixon, who was running that year, expected Kennedy to be the nominee even after Chappaquiddick. But he did not run, perhaps because of Chappaquiddick. In 1976, he surprised everybody by not running because the Watergate scandal had happened in the interim, which kind of erased memories of Chappaquiddick and gave the Democrats a big leg up, but Kennedy didn't run then, and he cited the fact that he had 17 fatherless nieces and nephews that he needed to be there for, between his kids and the kids of Bobby and Jack, and they were all at delicate ages. So by 1980, a lot of liberal Democrats were really angry at Ted Kennedy for having passed up these races, and a lot of them felt like Jimmy Carter had kind of come out of nowhere in 76 and was, to the left wing of the Democratic Party, you know, way too conservative, not committed enough to the party platform of jobs and health care, and that, you know, it was almost an obligation of Ted Kennedy to stand up and challenge him, and he did.
Do you think that Ted Kennedy had any sort of fear that he would be assassinated if he were elected?
It was very much on his mind. I don't know if it was fear that he would be assassinated if elected. I think that it was a present fear for him being assassinated even as a senator or as a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of poignant anecdote from an aide who talked about, you know, walking with him during the 70s and a car backfired and Kennedy was sort of flat on the ground. And when he sort of dusted himself off, he said, "You can never be too sure." And you know, there are statistics showing that after the president, Ted Kennedy always had the most death threats during that period. So it was, and during much of that period, he did not have Secret Service protection. So he was very much out there, you know, in choosing to put himself forward, to go to small events, to give speeches. You know, to this very day, you know, he's unguarded, he's out there, and it's been a constant factor in his life.
If he'd run in 1976, do you think he would have won?
Yes, I do. I think that was a very strong Democratic year. I also think that people had enough fresh memories of the Kennedys that there was a strong pro-Kennedy sentiment that would have superseded concerns about Chappaquiddick that year, particularly coming right after Watergate. I think the fact that he didn't run then, you know, if you're a person who is truly wanting to be president and truly feels like your life is not going to be complete, you know, on a very personal level, if you don't get it done, he would have run then if he really wanted it.
Well, you mentioned the nieces and nephews, and although that may not have been his true motivation for not running that year, he was, in fact, really involved in their lives.
He was deeply involved in their lives, and it came from his sense of family obligation. And there is a poignancy to somebody who puts aside his own natural skills and some of his own satisfaction to, you know, try to have a political career that mimics those of his dead brothers, to try to live up to a public service ideal that his parents espoused, and spends all of his personal life, or much of his personal life, tending to 17 children and trying to instill in them what he saw as the Kennedy family values. By all accounts, he was a very loving uncle and sort of surrogate father, and he would arrange camping trips and trips to historic sites, and really wanted all the kids to have a strong family sense that they were kind of one unit together. But unlike his father, Joe Kennedy Sr., who was a forceful figure, a strong disciplinarian, you know, Ted's own personal life was quite undisciplined, and he just wasn't suited to playing a disciplinary role. So the kids were kind of running wild, and despite his best efforts, he really wasn't able to rein them in to any sufficient extent.
And in fact, he was there drinking with William Kennedy Smith and his son the night that Smith was accused of raping a woman.
He was not present for the rape allegation,
but earlier they were
in a bar together in Palm Beach, and it was Easter weekend, and William Kennedy Smith met a woman in the bar, took her back to the family home, and it was on the beach outside their family home that the incident occurred, and Kennedy, you know, by all accounts was asleep in the house at the time, but the fact that, you know, he, the father figure, was busy going out to a, you know, bar that was kind of known as a pickup place with his son and his nephew in the wee morning hours on Easter weekend was a, you know, an unsavory picture.
Peter Escanelos is my guest. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe and editor of the new biography, Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. If you would like to join us or ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Peter Escanelos is my guest. He is Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe and editor of the new book, Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Peter, Orrin Hatch was elected in 1976 and would have at first seemed the ideal political nemesis for Ted Kennedy. Can you talk about how that relationship changed?
The relationship changed because Orrin Hatch sort of succeeded in what he wanted, where the Republicans gained control of the Senate, and the two were on a committee that handled labor and health care. The name has changed. It's now the HELP Committee for Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, but it's had various names over the years, but it's been the same committee. And Orrin Hatch took over in the 70s when the Republicans, or I'm sorry, Orrin Hatch took over in the early 90s when the Republicans gained control. And sort of quickly realized that he needed Ted Kennedy to get things done, because even though the Republicans had a majority, several liberal Republican senators who were on the committee had a deeper allegiance to Kennedy than to Hatch. And after years of hating Ted Kennedy, Orrin Hatch approached him and said, look, you know it and I know it. We have to work together to get things done. And they did work together, and they found common ground, particularly in the area of public health. One of Kennedy's great legislative skills is his ability to find friends even in the most unlikely places and to find allies in the most unlikely places. And, you know, Orrin Hatch is a very rock-ribbed conservative who to this day says, you know, he stands for everything that Ted Kennedy opposes. And yet, when it comes to public health, Hatch, who's a very clean-living Mormon, you know, believes strongly in public health programs. So Kennedy has been able to work with Hatch on a number of different initiatives, starting with AIDS research money and including the Ryan White Act, which now more than half the people with HIV in this country get funds through the Ryan White Act, and that's largely because of Kennedy and Hatch's efforts.
And it was Hatch who at one point told Kennedy he really needed to get his drinking back under control.
Yes. When Kennedy faced the Palm Beach scandal and some subsequent bad publicity surrounding the Clarence Thomas hearings, when it was clear that his personal life was affecting his ability to be a spokesman against Clarence Thomas when he was accused of sexual harassment, Hatch delivered a tough message to Kennedy that he really needed to get his drinking under control.
Has he ever been through any kind of rehab?
I don't think so. He always had an unusual drinking pattern in that, one of the measures of alcoholism is that people really can't do without it. But he had this pattern where he would quit drinking for the first 3.5 months of the year, and then after Easter would start drinking again. And it was just sort of a personal habit, and people are amazed that he's able to sort of turn it on and turn it off, given the amount that he was always reported to be drinking. I think that he's, brought it down into moderation in the last two decades and, has had no signs of any alcohol-related problems. But, it's always been a factor sort of out there in his life.
You talked about his healthcare collaborations with Orrin Hatch, and in fact, Kennedy thinks that his greatest misstep throughout his entire career actually happened in the Nixon administration.
His greatest misstep was that he didn't accept a national health insurance plan when Richard Nixon was offering one. And he's told our reporters this. Nixon was offering a plan that would work through private insurers to get everybody in the country covered, which is very similar to what Democrats have been proposing these days and what's being discussed right now in Washington. But 35 years ago, President Nixon was willing to support that. But Kennedy wanted a single-payer plan, wanted a more elaborate national health program, and criticized Nixon's plan as being too little, wouldn't do enough. Now he says they should have accepted it back then, made the commitment to universal health care, and then he would have had 35 years to, tinker with the plan and get it right and make improvements and expand coverage if needed. And I think that was a powerful lesson for him. What he learned over time was that you can't always get what you want in the Senate, and you have to take incremental steps towards a larger goal.
What is his working relationship like with reporters?
His working relationship with reporters is good. He's generally accessible to reporters, and his staff is attentive to reporters. It might surprise people that, like a lot of politicians, he's very, very image conscious. He's such a famous person, and one would think that his outsized personality and family background would sort of carry him along more than any one positive news story or negative news story or criticism here or criticism there. But he's quite attentive to it.
Does it bother him on a personal level that people who don't like him tend to absolutely despise him?
He has discussed that as being what he calls, the usual right-wing criticism, and sees some of it as being based on simple disagreement with his political stances. And I think he would say, be that as it may, I'm going to fight for what I believe in, and they're going to fight for what they believe in, and, we'll just have to disagree. I think to the extent that it is, people who question his character, it probably does bother him. And, as I was mentioning before, his efforts to sort of reach out to people in need in very quiet, private ways is sort of a way of saying, I am a caring person. I am somebody who understands, how to behave on a one-on-one level.
How did things change for him when he remarried?
Things changed a lot. His current wife, Victoria Reggie, was very, very different from his first wife. His first wife, Joan, did not have a strong interest in politics. Her passion was classical music, which he didn't share any interest in at all. And she tended to be a sort of quiet, demure figure, and he was a very outgoing figure. And, sometimes those kinds of opposites attract marriages work, but it didn't in their case. And Victoria, Reggie Kennedy, is a woman of a different generation than Joan. She's 20 years younger. And she was a lawyer, and she came from a big, boisterous political family of her own and understood politics and decided that she was going to share his political life as well as his personal life. She also is a an organization-oriented kind of person who brought a certain, you know, disciplinary rigor to the whole Kennedy family, you know, setting some rules and standards. You know, for Kennedy, it's allowed him, I think, to be more himself and to concentrate on the things that he likes and wants, you know, having somebody who's both looking after him and looking after the family.
Do you see him as a particularly self-aware person?
I think that he's aware in that he knows where he wants to go politically, far more than most politicians. Perhaps because he reconciled himself at a certain point to a Senate career and realized after 1994 that his seat was safe in Massachusetts, he didn't have to worry about positioning himself for political gain at all. So it's all been in his mind about where he wants the country to go and what it takes to move the country along. So to an extent far, far greater than the average senator, you know, he has a moral compass. He knows exactly where he wants to go on issues and on policies. And that's extraordinary. Now, everybody who knows him feels that he's not introverted at all. You know, they've never had a conversation where he talks about, you know, what people think of him, what his, you know, ultimate legacy and reputation are going to be. You know, he never has either expressed, you know, great distress over the Kennedy haters or, you know, a deep need for the Kennedy lovers to continue loving him. He in the last 30 years, has been pursuing his own agenda.
We have an email from Jim in Dallas who writes about something that comes up in the book. In 1980, there was a television news reporter, Roger Mudd, who asked Senator Kennedy why he wanted to be president. The senator was not able to give a coherent answer to the question. I've never heard a good answer as to why he didn't give a good answer. Do you have one?
Well, you know, one simple one is the interview was conducted 4 days before his official announcement, and he probably was trying to think, well, do I acknowledge that I'm officially running, or have we announced this yet or not? And that might account for some of that puzzled look on his face. So that may be just a, you know, that may be the practical thing that was on his mind. But other people would say, look, if anybody wants to be president and wants to run for president, they should be able to answer that question right off the top of their head, no matter what the timing is or the situation is or whether they want to build suspense for an announcement 4 days later. And so a lot of people see that as just simple evidence that, you know, it wasn't deep within him. You know, he had accepted the idea that he was going to run for president. He felt a family obligation to run for president. But when you really put it to him, he hadn't thought the whole thing through on a personal level.
Let's speak to Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. My question is, do the family tragedies and his own personal life experiences gave him the courage and strength to fight for the causes he believed in?
Yes, I think they did. I think that he had to decide after his brother's death whether he was going to give up politics himself or continue pursuing those causes at, you know, and at the time it really seemed like at the cost of his life. You know, it was a ever-present thing, these assassination threats that he was facing. And I think he decided, for some of the reasons that we mentioned before, that the causes come first. And obviously, when you've seen the cost up front, the way he did with the deaths of both of his brothers, you know, to make that decision requires a lot of courage, and it also requires a lot of belief in the causes that you're standing up for.
Any sense of what his counsel might have been to Caroline Kennedy when she was considering actively pursuing the Senate seat in New York?
I think that at this stage, he's a very loving uncle of Caroline Kennedy, and they have a very close relationship. So I think that, you know, he would just want her to have whatever she wanted. And if she stepped forward and said, I think I'm ready to run for the Senate or to be appointed to the Senate and then to run for the Senate, I think he would have been just supportive in the way that any loving family member would be supportive. If she really probed and asked him, you know, what does it take to succeed in the Senate? I'm sure he would have told her that it takes a lot of sacrifice and commitment, and that her life would change dramatically if she went into the Senate.
Well, and it's interesting that her response to the question as to why she wanted to be senator was very much a sort of a mirror of what he said in 1980.
I think they're very parallel situations. I mean, both of them, Ted Kennedy and running for president and Caroline and getting involved in politics, have had people for years urging them to run, and their closest family friends and people who believe in their relatives and the legacy of their of Caroline's father and things like that, you know, are constantly telling them, you've got to run, please run. We'd love to have you in public life. We need you in public life. And so they get this sort of false impression that all they have to do is say yes, finally, and everything will take care of itself. And I think for Caroline Kennedy, it probably was a difficult decision whether to run, whether to extend herself. It's probably something she's been wrestling with for a long time, and she probably thought, you know, her brother has died. Ted is facing cancer. Her uncle Ted is facing cancer. Her cousins have not, you know, stepped forward as national leaders in quite the way that some of them may have wanted. And so if anyone's going to carry on the legacy, it's going to be Caroline, and that she, you know, she was ready to do it. But it takes a lot more than just saying yes. And I think when you're in that cocoon where everybody's urging you to run, you don't realize that.
I know that the prognosis for the form of brain cancer that he has is quite grim. Can you talk about how Ted Kennedy is doing today physically?
Well, physically, he's been out in public the last week and a half, a little more than he had had the previous month. People say that he's working much of the day and working the phones as he always had, particularly concentrating on health care. He gave up his seat on the Judiciary Committee to focus exclusively on health care. But, you know, the treatment, the effect, after effects of the treatments that he's had and the operation that he's had does leave him tired, leave him susceptible to seizures under certain conditions. So I think his wife, Vicky, is, you know, keeping very tight control of his environment because, you know, it could cause a seizure if he exerts himself too much, and he's taking naps during the day. But for a good part of the day, he's continuing to work on the healthcare issue.
Any sense that he's interested in choosing the person who will ultimately succeed him?
There's certainly a lot of speculation, and some of the speculation centers on his wife, Vicky, but there's no actual indication that he or Vicky or anybody else has been talking about that. So it's a little bit unknown. It's something that's talked about in Massachusetts, but not very openly.
Peter Escanellos is Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. He edited the new biography, which comprises the work of a team of the Globe's reporters. It's called Last Lion: The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. Peter, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and